Thank you all for joining so promptly. My name is David Benjamin, and I'm one of the co-organizers of this meeting. Liz and Brad DeGraff are both also helping me with the meeting, and we're really happy to have him here. He's offered to give us some words of wisdom. He's looked over the book about the MetaWeb, and I'd like to just do a little housekeeping right now. So when you're not speaking, please stay on mute, and we're going to essentially go through several questions, and it looks like we have enough people that we'll probably go into breakout rooms to discuss them briefly. Liz, would you say maybe 5 minutes for each breakout room, given the number of people?
Yes, and because of Zoom, we have the power of the space-time continuum. So we'll say 5 minutes, and we'll see how the conversations go.
Okay, great. And if you, once we come back or whenever we're in the full group, if you want to speak, go ahead and put your hand up and certainly put your any comments or questions. Want people to be aware of, put them into chat. We'll be monitoring chat. And if there's a question, we'll bring it to the fore. We'll repeat the question as well. And so thank you all for coming. Wow, there's still more people coming in. It's great. And we've got 4 or 5 note takers, AI note takers. That's the time we're in, right? Okay. Are there any questions, or Liz, is there anything that you want to say, Brad, before we jump into this event?
Nothing from me.
Not me.
All right. Well, once again, thank you, Vint, so much for agreeing to give us some thoughts about this project. And I want to, anyone who isn't aware of who Vint is, he is one of the founders or one of the fathers of the internet. He also is the chief internet evangelist at Google, and he has been really helpful to me in terms of giving me comments throughout the process of the book, and with just really, really appreciative for him to come here and speak to us. So, Vint, we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to join you today. People who run around using things like words of wisdom always worry me. I have words, but whether they're wise or not, I think, is someone else's decision to decide. But I am happy to share a little bit about the experience of watching the internet begin and then blossom, and to try to extract from that some insight into what makes infrastructure possible. And I think here we have to all agree that the proposal is indeed a broad kind of infrastructure. It is layered on top of the existing internet or whatever the internet morphs into. And in fact, it's important to recognize that when you create this sort of overlay, it's important that you use the words agnostic or technology agnostic in some places, David. And I think that's fairly important. Those of you who know a little about the internet will know that the IP layer, the internet protocol layer, is insensitive to the underlying transport, and that was by choice. So we didn't care whether it was a radio or an optical fiber or dedicated piece of copper or something else. It was agnostic, and that was helpful because when new transport or transmission came along, we could just sweep them in as a layer to support the internet protocol. And the same argument could be made, by the way, for HTTP. As some of you will be aware, it runs on top of TCP/IP, but also runs on top of QUIC, which is another variant of an end-to-end protocol. And so one of the things that's important about this layer, this new layer that's proposed, is that it has this ability to run on top of more than one about is that the underlying infrastructure is that can support a common property. So, layer doesn't demand very much. It basically says, can you deliver this bundle of bits with some probability greater than zero? And you know, if it doesn't make it, there's above the IP layer have to recover from that. And ironically, some of you may remember that we originally, Bob Kahn and I originally designed just TCP as a reliable transport mechanism that delivered things in sequence. And then we discovered, thanks to others, that we needed to break off the user datagram protocol from the TCP layer and make it distinct, because some things needed to be delivered quickly, but not necessarily completely. Real-time voice was an example of that. Radar, which was one of our motivators, you don't want to know where the missile was. You want to know where it is. And so the low latency was very important, and that was a property that you didn't get from TCP if it had to do retransmissions. So anyway, the point here is that this new layer of functionality should be seen as infrastructure, that should, and all of the implications of that. So what are the implications? Well, one implication of infrastructure generally is that there are standards associated with it. And it would be hard to overemphasize the importance of standards in an enterprise of this kind, because you want things to interwork. And not everyone who is going to be participating in this infrastructure will necessarily be able to negotiate directly with every other possible party that they might interact with. And so the standards create the interoperability, which otherwise would be impossible to attain if you had to have pairwise agreements on what things, how things look and how things work. So I would argue that if there are not already standards described for this infrastructure, there will have to be some, and that will be important to be agreed. This also help with the continued growth of the infrastructure, the penetration into availability. Standards allow for parties to create competing products or competing services that have properties that are consistent. And so customers now have choice as a result of that, so that competition is aided by standards. And, of course, we want broad adoption, because in the absence of broad adoption, it doesn't do very much good. The benefits that come from an infrastructure like this are directly related to how broadly it's adopted and how widely it's used. Another lesson that we learned very quickly from internet experience is that there needed to be self-sustaining business models. When we started, of course, the governments were paying for all of this. It was originally the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency for the 80s, the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, and NASA built backbone networks in the U.S. I'm not trying to exclude all the other backbones that got built in other parts of the world, but just for purposes of this discussion, those were all government-sponsored activities, and the only parties who were allowed to use the Internet were people who had some relationship to one of those four agencies. Well, around the 1988 or 89 or so, I requested permission to connect the MCI mail commercial email system to the NSFNet backbone. And of course, this broke the appropriate use policy, which had limited access to these systems to people with contracts, with research contracts with the government. Of course, that was a very deliberate move on my part. And after having implemented that connection in 1989, three commercial internet service providers popped up in the U.S., UUNET, PSINET, and SurfNet in Southern California. And you'll also note that even before those networks became available, there were other commercialization efforts. For example, Cisco Systems and later Juniper were building routers that were purchased by universities in order to build access to the internet, and or 3Com for that matter, that was selling Ethernet cards or Ethernet network interface connectors. So those were self-sustaining businesses. Now, some of the businesses didn't survive. PSINet didn't. UUNet was later acquired, and I think SurfNet was acquired by AT&T. But the fact is there's a business model to support the investment that's needed to not only spread but also enhance the infrastructure. So, again, we'll have to look at this new infrastructure and ask questions like what business model makes it. I also want to emphasize the importance of simplicity. One thing we learned in the Internet Engineering Task Force is that if you're going to do something, try to do it only one way. Because as soon as you do it two ways or more than two ways, then there has to be a negotiation to find out which of the ways the two parties who want to communicate have chosen to implement. This was one of the reasons that X25, a predecessor to OSI, ran into trouble, and OSI had the same problem. They had five transport protocols instead of only one. Now, today we have two in the Internet. QUIC is one, and TCP/IP is the other. But what's happened is that the original design had only the one transport protocol. Well, I suppose I shouldn't say that, because UDP became a transport-level protocol, too. But minimizing complexity is our friend here. And finally, say that because of the nature of this infrastructure and because it involves strong authentication identity and possibly a basis for very important transactions that have significance, whether they're financial transactions or medical transactions or other things of high consequence, that security and safety and strong authenticity are going to be essential. So that this infrastructure is relatively impervious, that's a very peculiar formulation, but resistant anyway to various and sundry forms of attack. This observation is exacerbated by something else that's happening in our online community, and that's artificial intelligence, large language models and the like. And the reason that's an issue is that historically, we turned over where, in general, the ability to exercise or take actions that have an impact on the real world. My trivial example of this is the elevator bank, where you push the selection button to go up, and it says, what floor do you want to go to? And you select the floor. And when the elevator door opens up and you walk in, there are no controls in the inside of the elevator. You are completely dependent on someone else's software. This always makes me nervous because I used to make a living writing software, or to be really honest, I used to make a living writing bugs because I would write software that had bugs in them, not deliberately. So I worry about buggy software. And if you worry about buggy software, then you should doubly worry about buggy artificial intelligence algorithms, especially the large language models that hallucinate, and that's a formal term, apparently, in that community. So why do I tell you all this? Well, I say this because this infrastructure will invite, in my opinion, the use of artificial intelligence and machine learning and large language models to exercise actions on behalf of users like you and me. And that's not a bad thing, necessarily. If you look at the population demographics, and David, you're going to wonder where the hell is Surf going now. But if you look at population demographics, what you will discover is that with a few exceptions, most of the populations in the world are either declining or at least not growing. Now, that's not true in places like Africa, where Nigeria, for example, has a very continued rapid growth rate. China lost population last year. Its population went down. And countries like the U.S. Are similarly not reproducing themselves, but they have an influx of people immigrating into the country, and that's helpful because those people will can take jobs that that might not otherwise have been filled. That's going to put pressure on robotics or artificial intelligence to take actions that might otherwise have been undertaken by a person and now is undertaken by software. But once again, that means that reliability will be a high priority. Please remember, though, that humans are not perfect. Humans make mistakes. Every one of us, can, you know, I'm sure has a long list that we remember or that we wish we could forget. Robots will also make mistakes. Software will also make mistakes. But we should try very, very hard to reduce the likelihood of a mistake, especially if something is risky. So as an example, financial models, medical diagnosis and treatment, those are really high risk things. And we would like not only the people that offer us advice, but the software that might offer us advice to have very low likelihood of making a mistake. So I don't think you need more than this sort of warning about what you're attempting to do. What we need to do now, of course, is to get out some of the specifics of the implementations and figure out whether there are things that need to happen before we can implement this successfully and ask ourselves the most important question, what could possibly go wrong? And if we don't have answers to questions like that, then we are not in a safe spot to go implement something as significant as this infrastructure seems to be. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. And then we should go on to try to discuss the real substance of today's discussion.
Well, thank you so much, Vint. That was really helpful and insightful. I wanted to ask one question, then we're going to go to a question that Eric Harris Braun has. So the question I had, you mentioned safety, security, and authenticity. We've also talked a bit about accountability, and I would just like to hear a little bit about that from your perspective.
Yes, thank you so much for reminding me about that. My two watchwords these days are accountability and agency. On the accountability side, you know, for many years, I used to think that anonymity was a good thing and that we should promote that. You shouldn't have to identify yourself to make use of the resources of the Internet. And while I still believe that to be largely true, my concern about anonymity revolves around the fact that the Internet infrastructure and the artificial intelligence infrastructure have become amplifiers of everything. And the problem here is the everything part. Whether it's, you know, productive and useful and constructive or harmful and damaging, it gets amplified in this online environment, especially so, you know, in the social media, where replication and propagation have been a mechanism for, a business mechanism for those infrastructures to thrive. Because by propagating to friends of friends of friends, et cetera, et cetera, you end up getting more eyeballs, and eyeballs are what make advertising useful. So, or annoying, if you like. So, we now have the problem that parties can cause a great deal of damage using these online tools, and they should be held accountable. The challenge there is that the parties who may be doing damaging things, harming others, could be in one jurisdiction and the victims in another, which has led to a recent negotiation of a cybercrime treaty at the UN. There is a lot of dispute right now over whether that cybercrime treaty terms and conditions are satisfactory. There's a preceding one called the Budapest Convention, which some people think is preferable. But holding parties accountable is important, and the only way you can do that is to identify them. On the flip side of this, you don't want things, software or other people, to take actions on your behalf that you didn't authorize. And so strong authentication of you is actually beneficial. You, even though it may be annoying to have to use two-factor authentication or something else, that's in your best interest because you want to make it hard for others to take actions on your behalf that you didn't authorize. That implies that if there's going to be a software infrastructure that takes actions on your behalf, you have to make sure that it's very hard for a piece of software to exhibit bona fides that imply you have given authorization for the action that it's going to take. And so there has to be a very careful design and implementation of this mechanism, this transitive authority that might be beneficial to all of us, setting robots at work on our behalf, but only doing things that we've authorized. So accountability and authenticity. On the agency side, here we're speaking of what tools do we give you and the rest of the infrastructure in order to achieve those desirable properties that limit the actions taken on your behalf to those you've actually authorized. So thanks for reminding me about that, Debbie.
Oh, thank you for your answer. Eric Harris Braun, he's one of the co-founders of Holochain, asked this question. Related to this question of commercial adoption, who made the decision to not include pricing and cost in the protocol design, which seems to me to be a critical design element, not putting the self-sustaining into the protocol, but pushing that to the edges?
I think that was partly a consequence of circumstances. Please remember that when this work began in 1969 with the ARPANET, and then in 1973 with the Internet, that it was being paid for by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and it was intended to become part of the infrastructure of their command and control system. This was not designed to be a commercial enterprise. It was designed to support the American Defense Department and its allies. And I might point out that the reason Bob Kahn and I release the design of the Internet publicly in the 1974 paper in IEEE Transactions was specifically because we knew that the Allies would need to implement this so that the U.S. and its allies could interwork with each other. But then we went through this little cycle. We said, okay, so who are our allies in 1973? And there was a list. And then we said, who were our allies 25 years before? It was a different list. And then we said, who will our allies be 25 years from now? We didn't know. And so we said, okay, the only way to make sure that the allies, whoever the hell they're going to be, have access to this is just release it publicly, which we chose to do. And some people asked me, how the hell did you get away with that? And the answer was, well, we went through that analysis, and then we just released it, and nobody noticed. So, you know, there you go.
Rinta asks, Vint, could you pontificate on which encryption standards will become necessary moving forward, like the example of five relay protocols that are many proposed protocols in Protology?
Okay, so I'm sure most everyone on this call is well aware that the RSA and related algorithms that use the difficulty of factoring the products of large primes as their basic work factor. So RSA is an example of that, and there are others. Those algorithms are now potentially under threat with quantum computers becoming more real. And you want to be careful of the language I use here. I don't believe there exists a quantum computer yet that can break a significant cryptography algorithm that uses that particular work factor, but someday there will be. And since some information needs to be protected for decades, we have to anticipate that the quantum computers that decades from now will be capable of breaking some of today's typical public key crypto algorithms. So the National Institutes of Standards and Technology issued a request for information and received some 36 contributions of different cryptographic algorithms that did not suffer from the quantum threat of Shor's algorithm. They don't involve the use of factorization at all. They're basically, if I'm remembering right, they're all based on lattice mathematics problems. So they have now down selected to 4 algorithms, if I remember correctly, some for digital signatures and some for encryption. And I believe we've started implementing these at Google in the expectation that we should get them on available as quickly as we can to protect information that may need to be protected for decades. So at the moment, there seems to be a pretty good selection of responses to that threat. And I'm happy to say that NIST stepped in very quickly and aggressively to identify replacement algorithms.
Thank you. One last question is, understanding we don't know what we do not know, which, if any, tech on the horizon today could be the next internet?
I know that some people are hoping that somehow or other quantum entanglement will allow us to have a zero delay network. Of course, time is God's way of making sure that not everything happens all at once, unlike a science fiction movie where there's everything everywhere all at once. So unfortunately, quantum entanglement does not allow for zero delay communication. It's tempting to think it does, but it does not, at least based on our current understanding. So that's not the next big thing. If there is a next big thing, it's probably going to be related to the artificial intelligence work that's going on. And I want to emphasize that what we have seen so far, especially with large language models, is astonishing, surprising, and daunting. The last point is that we don't understand why it doesn't work when it doesn't work. We have some ideas, and I'm not expert, so I don't mean to argue that I know better than anyone else. But my impression right now is that the failures of these systems relate to what I will call context. Now, some of you heard the phrase context window. That's not what I'm talking about. Let me give you a concrete example. Some of you may have heard this before. I went to one of the chatbots and I said, please write an obituary for Vint Cerf. And the reason I did that was that I figured that the format of an obituary had probably been ingested by the train bot, because there are obituaries all over the internet. People die every day and they get obituaries written and they post it online. So I guessed that that format would be known to the large language model. And then I figured there was some stuff about me on the net, so we could find that too. Well, it did write an obituary. It started out, you know, we're sorry to report Dr. Cerf passed away. Then it gave a date that was much too soon, and I didn't like that very much. And then it went on to summarize my career, and it conflated stuff I did with stuff other people did. So I was getting credit for things I didn't do, and other people got credit for the things I did. And then when it got to the family members part, it had family members that made them up, you know, that these are family members that I don't have as far as I know. And so I'm sitting here thinking, how the hell does that happen? And my little cartoon answer to this is that when the system was looking at bios, for example, it didn't know that this paragraph was about Vint Cerf and this other paragraph was about somebody else. All it was doing was saying, what's the likelihood that this word would follow after the following other words? And so it could easily have plucked words from other people's bios and, you know, created this, you know, model, this statistical model of all the text it had ingested, and then just start generating stuff. So until we figure out how to provide context to the generative system, we're going to see these funny anomalies. The context window here's where the limits of my understanding of how these large language models work, but the context window, if it's big enough, creates a bias in the generative output that's related somehow to that context. Now that, and I'm right at my edge of my understanding of this stuff. And so the larger the window, the more context is available when it's in generative mode. But it's not clear to me that that solves the training problem, which is bereft of the adequate context. So one last thing I'll say about this is that my impression from talking to people who are working on this is that while there has been this ebullient expansion of the models to increase very much larger numbers of parameters of tokens into the billions, there is some appreciation for smaller models that are specialized, that have specific knowledge. And I think the trend right now is to figure out whether you can build a large language model or a large model that calls on specialist modules. And for those of you who have studied AI, you should be thinking of Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind. If you remember that book, his idea was that your brain is made up of multiple entities or multiple processes that collaborate and cooperate. And going even further back, if you look at the Sciences of the Artificial by Alan Newell, he had the idea that there were these processes in the brain and they shared a common blackboard so that their state information could be discovered. So I think that we're rediscovering some of the ideas of the past as we begin to work with these large statistical models. But we still have a lot of work to do to make them reliable, which motivates all the other reasons why I spoke earlier about being concerned about using these things to take actions in the real world. Sorry for these are really long answers. I apologize for that.
No need to apologize. Thank you so much for speaking with us and for being in this call. We're going to switch over now. I'm going to present a little bit about the inspiration behind the meeting and the purpose, and then we're going to jump into doing as much work as we can in the next half an hour. So the purpose for this meeting is to bring together a collaborative, or at least launch a collaborative, of people and organizations that want to contribute to building an application substrate for an environment above the web page. I've been calling that environment the overweb. Who knows whether that will stick. But the point here is that we want to make it very easy for people to build applications that build upon whatever protocol, platform, language, whatever, that they can build on top of the internet and use a common identity space and security model, as well as a model for managing how AIs interact within that environment, and to build it in a way that's lightweight, technology agnostic, secure, obviously simple as possible. So that's really the vision for why we're here together today. And the inspiration for me has a lot to do with context. I was noticing in 2015 or so that the web had so little context as we had shifted to the web to commercializing the web with social media and in really this data extraction model that leaves commercial entities with the incentive to keep people on their sites. So they stopped using so many outbound links, and in a sense, web surfing turned into feed surfing on social media. So anyway, that's the inspiration for this and the purpose. We're now going to transition to some collaborative working together. Liz is going to get us into some breakout groups around three guiding questions. Liz, you want to talk about those questions? And oh, before that, I just want to mention there is a collaborative note-taking document, which I am putting the link in there right now. Liz, you want to take it over?
I don't want to take it over, but I'm happy to jump in. Thank you so much, David. Thank you for pulling this amazing group together and for all of the passion and the energy, and Brad as well, everything that went into planning. What we'd like to do for the next 25 minutes, because we are going to honor time, is to break out into some smaller groups around three guiding questions. And we call them guiding questions because this is not a test. This is an opportunity for us to explore and co-create together. Putting those questions into the chat. The first one is a question about our purpose. And it's very easy to get into broad brush conversations about purpose. The question for this group is, what is a unique, valuable contribution that this initiative, this group of people can make to the meta layer? Because there are many, many things that can be done. What would be unique and valuable that this group is best positioned to do? So that's one question we would like to explore. We'd like to next explore, what would a meaningful first milestone look like? And that is going to take a little bit of negotiation among us to say, well, what do we recognize as a milestone? And what is meaningful to us? And that's not something that any one person can dictate from the center here. This is something that we have to come to our consensus on. And then the third piece that we'd like to talk about while we're here together today is how we can organize ourselves to work toward this initial meaningful milestone. And from there, we'll see where the energy of the group is and where this is going to take us. So if, are there any questions about the questions? What I would suggest, given time that we want to be able to come back together and close, is that let's see if we can have each group take about, let's put everybody together for one period of time. Let's aim for it to be about 10 to 12 minutes. And let's ask that the group self-manage and dig into these questions and see if there's one that pulls you more toward it. You don't have to spend equal time on everything, but when we come back together, it would be great if we can get some input and thoughts from each of the groups on one or more of the guiding questions as we go through them. And then we'll be able to kind of come together, close, and talk about where we're going to go next. So, Devine, I'm going to hand it back to you while I make some breakout rooms.
All right. Yeah. Well, I think we will we'll be together for 5 minutes of each breakout room. Is that what you're thinking, Liz? And
it's been actually, I think Liz said 10 to 12 minutes. I think that's right. I don't believe that you could get anything done in 5 minutes.
I think we're going to try to spend about 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think we're only going to be able to do one iteration, because otherwise by the time everybody introduces themselves, we have to move on.
Yeah. And so all three questions at once, or? Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Well, yeah, in terms of this initiative, I like to really present that this is nothing new. I mean, the notion of building in the space above the web, although maybe people didn't explicitly think about it as with the complexity that we're going to be talking about it in the next 25 minutes, this was something that was with the web before the web. I mean, web annotation is inspired by annotation itself. And annotation is something that humans have been doing for over 1,000 years. When people started thinking about knowledge systems, both physical and digital, annotation was built in from the absolute beginning. And many people don't realize this, but Mosaic, the first widely had annotation in it. So we're simply with this, I like to think about is really reinstalling the big missing feature of the web. Are we ready, Liz? Or? Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's something that is really interesting to me, because in 2012, Mark Andreessen, he bought, they invested, Andreessen Horowitz invested in Rap Genius, and he named a couple reasons why he did it. And he said perhaps the most important one was it was bringing back this ability to layer knowledge on top of knowledge, which is super significant coming from, you know, one of the top VCs and the father of the browser, yet no one paid any attention to it. And he also, in that article, this blog that they wrote about why they were purchasing it, he said, I often wonder what the world would be, what the web would be like right now if we had not had to remove annotation from the browser. Because, like I said, Netscape, Mosaic turned into Netscape, and because Microsoft was preloading the Internet Explorer on all the PCs, which was 90% of the market at that time, Netscape was under tremendous threat, and there was no cloud, there was no peer-to-peer, so they didn't have a place to store the information. They would have to spin up an annotation server in this really hostile environment, and it just didn't seem like it was something that was worthwhile to do. Now, of course, there's many, many applications that are working in the annotation space now. Like Oh, you're there?
Okay. We are ready to go.
Let's go.
All right. Hang on, everybody. You are being sent to your rooms. I'm a mom. I get to say that.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, that's interesting. So we're a little room. Hi, Olaf. Good to see you. Now he disappeared. Okay, so much for that theory.
He's going to his room.
Okay. Is it going to assign us, or?
So the way that it works is that there is only one person. There should only be three people who are unassigned, and it should be everything else is a note taker.
Okay.
But yes, everyone else has been assigned to a room. I don't know that they've necessarily. Not everybody has chosen to join their room.
Okay, can we send a message to people just telling them that, just reminding them that they can take notes in the collaboration document, which I did post.
Yes, I believe that we can. I need to take a look at how to do that, though.
Okay.
I can broadcast a message. Okay, so I should just drop. Let me drop the link that you sent. Could you put the link in the chat? There it is. Okay. I got it. I'm just going to copy and paste it in.
Okay.
And then everybody should have that. And everyone should be good to go.
Awesome. So we're a group, huh?
We are a group.
We're the unassigned group.
We're the renegades.
Yeah, so, you know, I made a few notes for myself in case I was going to be put into a chat group.
Well, you are in a chat group.
It's just this one. So I'm looking at possible things that would be beneficial. One of them would be having strong federated authentication so that multiple parties could be the source of authentication or validation of a person. But you'd want it to be competitive in the same sense that certificate authorities are competitive. The unfortunate thing about certificate authorities is that they not turned out to be uniformly reliable. And so what has happened is that the browser people to make use of certificate authorities in order to do, for example, domain name lookups and things like that, have instituted an oversight of the certificate authorities, and if they're not satisfied with the transparency of the certificate authority, they refuse, they mutually agree not to accept the authority of that certificate authority. So it's a very interesting internal regulatory practice that's literally kind of evolved out of the use of certificate authorities for the domain name system, among other things. So I think if we could come up with a standard but federated strong authentication and had a mechanism for regulating it, that might turn out to be a very useful element in this overlay system.
Well, and that is a really unique contribution that this group can make. It's valuable, it's discreet, and it is, as I was thinking about this, I mean, just this, the idea invites boiling the ocean, which guarantees that we don't get anywhere because it's overwhelming. And so I think that what being able to focus on something that will move it forward meaningfully and create a way for other people to then plug in and join.
So there's an exercise that I usually encourage, in things like this. So one of them would be an essay that's titled Desirable Properties of the Meta Layer. And you'd want to lay out what those properties are. And the value of that is twofold. First, it becomes specific. And second, it tells you something about the ensemble of things that the meta layer has to implement to make it desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way to make things more specific. And then you get to pick on the property that you think you want to focus on. What would be required for that property to be realized? And what assumptions would you have to make? What agreements would have to be in place? What mechanisms would be required? And in the case of federated authentication, it not only would you want something that is accountable in the sense that who authenticated that party in the event that the party behaves badly, the party who authenticated properties of that party ought to be responsible. So that gets to Debbie's point about accountability and identifiability. And I was thinking a little bit about the culture that emerges out of some of these things. In our culture, historically, has given a lot of credibility to anonymity. We have kinds of mechanisms for anonymous reporting and this, that, and the other. I'm wondering whether we could see a cultural shift where you give more credibility to somebody who deliberately identifies themselves in a strongly authenticated way. Just because, now I'll give you a counterexample, Trump mm-hmm. is easily identifiable and what he says is mostly bullshit. Mm-hmm. So, but at least we know where it came from. That means we know why it should be considered bullshit. Hi, Colin. We're just speculating a little bit about the properties of the meta layer, I was talking about strong authentication as a kind of badge of honor. That is to say, if someone is willing to step up and say, "This is my opinion. Here's who I am. You can validate that."
Mm-hmm.
If what you say is baloney, at least you know where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good morning. Yeah, attestation, I think, is a big part of that accountability layer, right? How do you attest? And especially you were talking about the context of AI information, how do you make contextual information attested to one another to create that kind of semantic layer, right? Mm-hmm.
This is the provenance is another word that we didn't use in our preamble, but it's important. This is in the art world, provenance of an expensive art object is really important. And that should be true for information as well.
Have Any of you looked at the nano publication spec? The RDF?
What Ronan and Wesley are working on?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They referencing nanopubs? Or they're using nanopub spec? Yeah, it's super cool. It's really simple, like RDF, immutable, publicly available.
I was exploring it with them because one of the things I'm interested in solving is the mess that is academic publishing. And I'm really interested in how we make, so peer review, for example, like what a great way of crowdsourcing peer review and opening it up such that people can contribute into science and do it in micro ways. So you're not actually asking someone to be an expert on everything. You're asking them to focus on the thing that they could annotate and make a comment on.
Just to pick on that, Liz, for one second, as an example, what could possibly go wrong? what we've learned is that those sort of open feedback mechanisms can be used to pull in a polluted way. Copyright claims, as an example, are used against YouTube, where parties are essentially interfering with legitimate work or business by others, claiming copyright that they don't have. And it triggers all kinds of consequences. So figuring out how to build these systems that don't have downsides like that is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really difficult.
So the reason that the strong authentication is attractive is that it creates an accountability opportunity. And so if you can use accountability as a way of constraining behavior, and you build that mechanism in, it's sort of like being put in the penalty box. In ice hockey, you know, you're in the penalty box for 5 minutes because you committed an infraction. So finding ways of building feedback loops that that reduce the likelihood or reduce the incentive for bad behavior is an important design criterion.
Well, and I think a big part of it is that you absolutely need that kind of authentication because the part of what I also want to solve for is reviewer too. And so how is it that we create the opportunity for multiple people to engage while at the same time there's a reputation element to it? There's an authenticated element to it. And part of it can also be tied to compensation. If we don't know who you are, we can't compensate you for your contributions. And so I think that's something I've been thinking about as well, because one of the things that I want to solve, what I think we should be solving with this, is the harassment and bullying, particularly of minoritized and marginalized researchers and scholars, who are essentially kicked out of their spaces by people who just relentlessly harass them. And technology has made it very easy to harass at scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask a timekeeping question. We have about 7 minutes before the end of the hour. I was going to give everybody 60 seconds and close the rooms and bring everyone back. Does that work?
Yeah. If you can give them a 2-minute warning, that would be good.
I will give them a I will give them a 2-minute warning.
This is one of the awkward things about these mechanisms is that they're so abrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. What you said about giving people more credibility based on their identifying themselves more, I think is really important. And I could see I don't know if this is in the application at substrate level or if this is mainly in the application level of using the information about what people have authenticated to basically having different tiers of usage in the applications, you can see this, you can contribute this, you can do more things, you can earn money depending on where you are in the extent to which you've identified yourself.
At Google, we have badges that are part of our internal personnel system. And, you know, you get a badge for having taken a class or done something. And the badging, in a funny way, is a way of establishing credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So not quite clear how you do this at scale, but it's an interesting, has interesting properties.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We have access to an expert in badging, digital badging, out of the University of Buffalo. So that's someone that we can bring into the process for sure. I think it's really a good point. I put it in the document.
You know what we
need? I think it would
help. Take all the language that we're using to describe this and create, what do they call those things? Word salad thing?
Word salad thing?
Yeah, well, there, you know, it's a little display that shows the words that are used, and the big ones, the ones that are most frequent are big. There's
a
term for that. It's word something or
word cloud.
Yeah, word cloud. Yes.
So we might want to look at the word cloud associated with this project.
Yeah, you know, also I think a landscape diagram that shows all the different players or companies or products that are in the operating already in the meta layer, even though it's, you know, it's at a nascent scale and certainly not where we're trying to go. I think there's inspiration to be taken from these other projects, and it's great that people are already active.
We probably want to look at a variety of ways of kind of capturing and analyzing the data. Which, when anyone says word cloud, because it's a histogram, it's just a really pretty one. And when you have terms that are not necessarily well defined or agreed upon by everyone, you end up sort of slipping into counting the number of times that a word shows up as opposed to necessarily understanding the theme that the word might represent to one person versus another. So I think that there's a lot of value in the thematic analysis, and then contrasting that with the content analysis, which is what a word cloud gets you.
And maybe a glossary probably at some point would be something helpful for this as well, I'm imagining.
Yes. So we are back, and we retained a remarkable number of people coming back from the breakout rooms, which is excellent. We are going to go kind of around the horn. I am going to pick the room by room. I can tell you who are in the rooms, and then we would ask to self-appoint to kind of read out. And so I will start with room one, Brad and Christine.
All right. Well, Christine arrived just before we went into the breakout room, so I gave her a little bit of background on what everything was. She's very focused on internet privacy. She's a big shot in the internet trust world. So we talked a lot about identity, proof of humanity, how do you do annotation with when you need to be able to trust who the person is that's making annotations, but also those people may definitely need to be private and anonymous in a lot of cases. So we mostly talked about
Thank you.
Room number two, Bruce, Josh, Melinda.
Hey, greetings. Yeah, it was a pleasure to work. Connect with Bruce and Melinda. We had spoken about a little bit of privacy as well, and just trying to create a safe space. And ultimately, we were talking about maybe the commerce capabilities of this particular layer and how it can be intertwined and beneficial even for the smallest of businesses.
Thank you. Room three, Fossa and Sarah.
We were in there with Colin as well, and we kind of got cut out pretty early before we were able to get discussion. He got disconnected, but we just briefly talked about the interoperability aspect of it and how important standards were, and that this group, especially care about this particular subject, to help to put together an open approach to standards and best practices and stuff, so that we can ensure that there's a good process for people to be involved with.
Mm. The themes are coming out. Next room, Matt Schutte, Olaf, Robert, and Tyson.
Similarly, we spoke about standards and about standards emerging out of communities actually trying to do implementations and them needing to come together. And so that, well, I can leave it there. And I did notice Vince note that he has to leave as well, so I want to acknowledge. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dimitri and John.
So I was not in with Dimitri. I was in with Kevin and Roy, but they've left. They've left the premises. And Kevin did actually post to the chat a kind of a brief overview of our thing. You know, we frankly are still unclear on what the real use cases are that are going to motivate users to use the services. And so, I think all three of us were still unclear kind of what we're trying to achieve.
Fair.
Can I just say one thing is that after this, if anyone wants to talk about what could be achieved with something like this, I'm willing to stay on and invite other people to stay on for 10 or 15 more minutes. But Liz.
LCC and Melanie McDougall. Melanie, I think you're on mute.
Yeah. We also had Doug Hohulin in our room as well. Lawrence, Doug, and I talked a little bit about quick intros and what we're doing. There was some discussion on how a group of this size could really collaborate on finding the best ways to achieve these kinds of goals, and trying to understand where we might all fit together. We also did some quick intros on the different projects we're personally working on and how we could fit. Lawrence shared a few things around his work around the liminal web and how they're trying to create social networks that are organized in ways that can link different topics. And I shared a bit about Goodly Labs, which is our R&D lab that develops tools to support democracy, and Public Editor, which is annotating news for manipulative language. And Doug discussed a little bit about the protocols that could potentially link all of this.
Thank you. All right, last but not least, Eric, Harvey, Ronan, and Saul.
I can take a stab at it. I think we landed on a couple things really quickly. One of them, there's a lot of different disciplines, backgrounds, interests, probably corporate walls in some cases across this collective group. So finding a common target and series of outcomes would be really helpful. I'll be honest, I didn't do the homework because I got it like 5 minutes before the show started. So I'll dig in a little bit deeper on that for myself personally, but I think collectively knowing what the outcome and the ambition, you know, what's that round table we're all going to work with, and how do we create, you know, opportunities to drop the silos. And I think the other, you know, big thing that we saw as a sort of a, you know, beyond that first milestone, if we're trying to organize, you know, there's a couple different things that came to the table. One of them is, how is this sort of, what's the gas? How are we funding this? Is this a foundation at the end of this thing? Is there already an existing apparatus that should be leveraged, you know, existing foundations or something a little bit more corporate? You know, we're very interested in sort of understanding how do you get to the long-term goal and understanding what that is, but also what's the roadmap to get you there. So I think that's a good summary of where we were. We found some tools and things that would definitely help us along the way, and I didn't say the word sovereignty more than three times, I swear. That's it.
Thank you. Davide, I'll turn it back over to you.
All right. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, everybody, for participating in this meeting. It has been really interesting to me. I learned a lot in our breakout group, which we didn't report on, so maybe I think I'll go ahead and mention one of the, I think, most interesting ideas that came out of it was that we could focus on creating a standard for federated strong authentication, and that this would potentially create more accountability. It could allow for feedback loops that reduce the incentive for bad behavior, reputation, and compensation could be tied into it, as well as the ability to give people who authenticate at higher levels applications that are built could give them a different abilities within the application based on the authentication. And there were a couple other things that came up, badging, some kind of word cloud or histogram that shows the use of words, but then also, Liz, how did you put that?
We want to look at the qualitative and the quantitative data that comes out of it, and we want to sort of synthesize it so that we can understand thematically where we want to go. Are you talking about the nano publishing piece that we talked about when Colin joined?
That was the last thing, was the nano publications. Colin brought that up as a very powerful standard. And in fact, we've got Ronan in on the call with Sense Making Networks that are working on that. So that's another aspect that got brought up, and the potential of us coming together and building a landscape diagram of who's in the space, who's already operating in the meta layer, even though they don't talk about it that way, like, say, Hypothesis and Digo and Honey, et cetera. So those are the things we talked about. Were there any other ones? One more was an essay. So this is a meaningful first milestone. It could be an essay on the desirable properties of the meta layer. Liz, you were saying?
I was just going to say, for those who are hoping that we can kind of close now and then we can leave some space for those who wish to remain, the next steps, what should the participants on the call expect to see next from their participation here and going forward?
Yeah, we'll send an email to the people who participated, and even some of the number of people said that they weren't able to make, so we'll go to them as well, and it will have some thoughts about how to move forward, including the link to the document. We'd love to see people include any insights that they had from this conversation, from their breakouts, any further reflections that come after the meeting, and if we can get those into the document. And we'll be beginning to organize ourselves to at least propose a first milestone to the group and see how people want to participate, contribute, and organize together to achieve that. Any other thoughts, Liz?
Brad?
I was just putting some notes into the doc. One of the things that I think would be really helpful is something visual, some way of thinking about what we're talking about in the sense of user experience and all that. I mean, I think it's a broad, it's a big idea, and it's kind of hard to get your mind around, and some, and even just kind of simplistic, you know, experiments in like what would this look like might be useful.
Yeah, I totally agree with Brad here, and I want to also stress one more point, or point out one more point that was mentioned in the chat or in the rooms, that when it comes to a project that big, I think it also or we should also make some space for things when it comes to projects, like a project plan, a budget, but also, and more importantly, from my perspective, that what also me as a person can bring to the table is business models, like, because, and that's why I think what Brad just said is a very valid point to visualize this, and also to say, okay, what this is actually about, and to narrow it down to specific characteristics or parts or tools, to then explain, okay, this is how we can monetize on it. And this is also how, when we are talking about funding in a later stage, to pitch that to investors and stuff.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both. We're going to close the official meeting. I really appreciate all of you, and from our organizing team, you know, a big thank you to them and from them to all the participants. A big thank you to Vince Cerf for being such an amazing special guest and providing so much words of wisdom, even though he doesn't really necessarily want to call them words of wisdom. They certainly were wise, both in the breakout group and in the general conversation that he gave us. So once again, I will be sending out an email shortly. If anyone wants to stay on and talk, then, you know, happy to stay on 15 or 20 more minutes.
Thank you, David.
Yes. So the one thing, the funding thing, you brought it up, Robert. I think if we can get this first milestone done, I mean, ideally this first milestone will also include everything we need in a way to put out some grant proposals to actually get this funded. Because, you know, I know none of us can do anything like this on a sustained basis or even for very long without having some funding associated with it. So I see that as a big priority for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and also makes sense, I think, to put some structure in it. I mean, to be fair, I'm a very structured person, and but I, at the same time, I love the agile approach to this kind of work. But I think that also sets a goal, short term, mid term, long term, what we want to accomplish here, and the funding, but also the business models seem to be a fair portion on the whole project.
Yeah, well, I think that is a group that we could start now, essentially, or we already have already kind of started it. We've got there are other people who are interested, Robert, perhaps yourself and other people, if you're interested in, you know, helping us with the next stage of organizing this, more than happy to have you on.
Yeah, sounds good.
And so anyone else.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And anyone else, you either can send a message, you can put something in chat, or however. Let's see. So are there any questions, thoughts, comments, reflections that are burning and people would like to bring them up? This question of what the use cases are, really, it kind of confounds me in a way. Because in my mind, the use cases are as vast as the use cases of the internet. I mean, just because, I mean, we're building on top of the internet. So it seems to me that anything that someone's doing on the internet, you can aggregate information, have more context, you can essentially do what you're doing now with whatever web page in perhaps in a better way. And I think we need to get to the point where we can really explain to someone, you know, how this works. And it's so vast. It's like, where do you start in terms of, you know, the use cases? Any thoughts?
I think that's part of it, David. It's very exciting to talk about the art of the possible. But where we need to probably get to is the art of the practical. And so it's a question of how do we make something that is immediate and actionable that solves a real problem? Mm-hmm. Otherwise we end up with a lot of what we see in the whole decentralized distributed web space now, which is a lot of solutions in search of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I look at the things that are most successful. They're ones that solve an immediate human-centered problem. And they are simple to set up, simple to access. So it's frictionless. And so I think what it is for this is a question of, yes, they're part of the problem is we can do everything. And so the use cases are endless. What is a pinprick of a problem that we can solve with this and solve it in a straightforward way? It may not be really fast, but it would be helpful if we could get there somewhat quickly. And so I think it's getting really practical and granular and kind of gritty. And I think that's where the questions come from, because everybody can see the vision. Everybody can see the grand picture. But it's like, okay, how does this make my life easier, better, faster, cheaper, less painful tomorrow?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And Sala, I saw you had your hand up after David.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond one second and say that there are companies that are working in the space right now, and I think that they could benefit by kind of sharing the audience of people who are willing to participate in that space. And there's also companies or products that are working to analyze information, but their information ends up in a silo and they don't, and yeah, there's people all over the web that could be interested in based on what page they're on. So Solomon, what's your thoughts?
I was going to echo a little bit about what Liz said, but mainly bring up the topic of trust. It's a hard problem to get right. It's something I've been exposed to most of my career. And it's not just of the technology. That's the first hurdle you got to get past. Like, how do I trust this above and beyond the internet? Or I already don't trust the internet and you're right on the internet. How do you prove to me that you're doing better than, you know, so that trust aspect of it. But there's also the problems that you'll solve as a use case, whether you're taking on communications, a whole new economy, you know, how you present a page to get, you know, on a website, whatever those are, getting people to trust the outcomes of that and the trust of the betterment of their life is another key hurdle. There's this tipping point everybody always talks about. And one of the reasons there's a tipping point is there's a lot of pressure on technology adoption. It has nothing to do with the technology itself. It has everything to do with perception. But trust perception is really important. No matter how far along you are on an innovation, the adoption curve and the acceptance of something from a trust standpoint, it's a human perspective problem. And so that's just one thing I would make sure, no matter what you pick, have that as a pillar of understanding, like, how are we going to solve the problem because we understand the problem and we can prove to others we solved the problem and they trust the outcome of that. Because I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people that have gone through that in different forms and factors and have lost the trust of the consumer at the end or lost the trust of the enterprise, whatever it is. You know, SolarWinds, they're still recovering. Like, these are like, there's so many ways you can mess up the trust. And so if you don't have it as a focus, it's going to be a challenge. But it's a benefit too. When you're focused on one pinprick problem and you're also focused on making sure it's trusted and trustworthy and worthy of people adopting trust, and you put a program again around it, your outcomes are radically different.
a business case right there.
Yeah. I think if it's trusted communications, I mean, that in and of itself, that's a big problem. Like, what's everybody's favorite chat tool? Why aren't we all using the same one? Which one do you trust more versus the other? Do you like WhatsApp? Do you like Signal? Do you like LinkedIn? Because it's, you know, there. You know, like, there's all these choices that people make based upon their perception of things. So just something to think about.
Yeah. I think that the trust is really important, and it's echoed in what, you know, this conversation that we had with Vint in the breakout around a strong federated authentication. And, yeah, in a way, trust and accountability in a collaborative space could be a powerful use case.
Yeah. And there's another thing. So if you're putting in infrastructure, there's a collective trust that you have to put together. Like, you know, somebody's going to run the machines that make sure that everything works. Like, you can decentralize and distribute a lot of things, but some stuff like infrastructure talking to the internet, it's going to be really hard to. So you have to rely upon collective trust of operations and technologies that, you know, some of it might look like existing tech that you still rely upon because you're on top of the internet. And if the internet goes south or someone targets your entry point of the internet, that's a new problem. So just something to be conscious of. I apologize for being a downer. That's my background. I did a lot of work with the CIA, so I'm really passionate about making sure keep your stuff secret and keep your stuff available and keep yourself safe.
Yeah, thank you. Any other thoughts, people, or questions, comments, reflections?
Not for now, thank you.
Okay. Tyson, you have any thoughts?
I certainly think it's interesting. I would like to ask if if a mental model of, say, in a village or city, you would have properties and you have a water mains system. And if you have a property, you can, for a fee, you can gain access to the water supply. Now, is something similar where you could have a data water system where there's this meta layer of all sorts of data, advertisements, movies, you know, classified ads that would be available to like a web client to essentially ask to be open to? Is that an appropriate model?
What do you think, Liz?
I like that as a starting point for thinking. I think that coming back to the idea of communities is really important in this process, because when I think about, and Vint kind of alluded to this in his opening comments, the initial idea was not boiling the ocean with the internet, right? It was built for a very specific purpose, right? There was a very specific case, and it was about a particular community. That was the defense community and then allies, right? So it's this community and then connecting this community with others. And I think that as we consider like our mental models for this, coming back to the idea of how do we allow communities to govern themselves, to communicate with one another, to exchange, and then how do we create less friction between those communities when they want to interact with one another? I think that's kind of the way that I would approach thinking about it is, what is the layer that allows for frictionless communication and interaction between communities when those communities themselves have amorphous and porous borders?
Yeah. So Ben, did you want to vocalize some of the things you're writing in chat? I find them, you know, very aligned with the conversation we're having right now.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to put some thoughts down. I came in late. I apologize. I feel like I'm lurking. But I think that the issue of starting with some first principles of authentication that gives a valid identity, and attendant to that is an understanding of
of rights and authorities that any entity has. And I'm not just talking people. I'm talking any artifact or entity as well. And so as a principle of growth, then you incorporate the establishment of communities, as Liz is talking about, and how how communities form independently, and then how communities decide to engage with each other with appropriate behavior, as Solomon's talking about, that sets the governance of starting with trust, not ending with trust.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the concepts that we've been excited about, the group of us that have been thinking and working on this for a number of years now, is meta-community. So it's an idea of a community where you know that every single person within that community is a real person and they're in good standing with the system. And they are active with you over the entire web, so that when you go to a web page, you can see, if you decide to be visible, you can see all the other people who are in your community, and you know they're real people. You can see them in a list, because you basically have you're tapping into who's there on the web page at the same time, who happened to be in your community. Or you can see who was there before, and you can say, oh, Liz, I saw that you were on this page about new technologies, and you know, I was there too. What did you think about that? I wouldn't have known otherwise that she was there. But even though we're friends and we're colleagues, I'm particularly interested in this aspect of the work. So there's also the serendipity of meeting other people on that web page that, you know, maybe they're part of your larger community, and you know they're a real person once again, right? It's different than being on Facebook and, you know, having two or three people have contacted me this week, you know, saying they want to connect. I have no idea. You know, one of them asked me after three questions, have you heard of the stock market? So, I ended up blocking that person. But if these are real people and you can tell, like, how long they've been involved with the system, and you can see the artifacts that they either left on web pages or the chats that they've done, even if you don't necessarily know their name, it's still very powerful, because I think you all are, you know, we're kind of circling something very interesting. Any other thought? Dimitri, would you like to just talk a little bit about, you know, what you're doing? Dimitri's been working actively in the space for several years, at least, that I know of. Probably 5 or 6 years. You there? Okay, well, he may not, maybe his computer's on, maybe he's not able to talk, but I hope at some point he will be able to speak to the group. I did put a summary of his work in the collaborative document, so it's called Dapolis. Any other thoughts, reflections, questions?
I have a question. Is there a concept around, at a technical level, how you would implement this data layer? If you talk about having the ability for a website to have information, say, who's been there that you know, commenting, how would that data be, a federated thing, like just a classic kind of decentralized federated where you can run a node? Or I'm just curious, at the technical level, what kind of thinking has been?
Yeah, I think that some blockchain-like technology would be used, and, you know, certainly existing cryptography, or maybe not the currently prominent cryptography, because Vint was saying that a lot of people are starting to think about quantum resistance, and I think Shaw is not resistant at the moment, but NIST did a call for information, and they found out 31 new encryption algorithms that could potentially be brought in place. But anyway, I think so existing cryptography, browser tech, and then some kind of Web3 background and interfaces with AI are some of at least the main technologies that we'd be using. Solomon?
Yeah, I was going to comment on the crypto a little bit. You know, if you do choose to go with decentralized ledgers or distributed ledgers, cryptography is a sticky point right now. Even though they just released the last four new great algorithms for post-quantum, we've seen this rodeo before in the crypto, in the cryptography space. And what's the next challenge is people implementing it right. Okay. They do it wrong a lot. Like, ever heard of Heartbleed? That was bad crypto. That was just somebody who wrote bad code. So implementing new algorithms is always tricky, and I think there's going to be some rockiness for a while. So it's actually safer in most decisions to either stick with what already works, since it hasn't been compromised yet to our knowledge. You can go down the path of putting something new in, but make sure you're relying upon sort of a hybrid, because there's some parts of it that'll work well, some that won't. But the third one is you can abandon encryption altogether and go to things like one-time pads. It's by far the most secure way to communicate between two points. It's you just both have the same key, you use it once, and you throw it away. And it's not even a key, it's just garbage. And you both have the same garbage, and you have a number next to that garbage saying, we're going to use garbage 27 today, and you do a transaction 27, you throw it away. So I just say, if you're going after this big, this ambitious goal, you know, there's nothing wrong with thinking outside the box. Like, well, why don't we just remove encryption from the equation if we can find a way to distribute the secrets? So just something to think about, because I think, you know, relying upon NIST, as much as I have colleagues there, I wouldn't put all my eggs in that basket right yet with the new crypto. So just a word of the lessons learned, I guess.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been thinking, so Sol and I talk frequently, and one of the analogies that we batted around a while ago was we were talking about how as the technology, as cryptography and encryption technology gets even better, the tools to defeat it will get even better. And it's been pointed out to the place where you have quantum computing that really can render it almost obsolete. And so I go back to my dad standing over the garbage bin, cutting up the credit card, which is essentially the same thing that Voldemort did with his soul. And so I start to think about, there are some very basic but almost analog approaches. It's essentially a game of hide and seek. And so I start thinking about with distributing data and then leaving breadcrumbs, right? You have to leave breadcrumbs so that you can put it back together again. But what are some of the basic and simple ways that human beings have been keeping things secret for millennia? And there are some things that are very secure. And then there are some, like, you know, my daughter's reliance on her diary lock and not understanding that her sister has become quite handy with a bobby pin. And so how do we find the right level of security for what we're doing? And how do we also, as we consider how much information has the ability to be captured, analyzed, annotated, shared, how do we also be really mindful of the things that are anonymous versus the things that are private versus the things that are secret versus things that are confidential? A lot of those terms right now are all being conflated, and they don't mean the same thing. And they're not all necessary in all situations. So how do we think about that a bit? There's no suggestions in there. It's just more questions.
Oh, I was saying that's a great question and a great starting point. I'm wondering, are there any more questions, thoughts, reflections that want to be surfaced now? All right. Liz, you think?
I personally think that jet lag might be catching up. I apologize that my little motor is running down. It's about 25 to midnight in Singapore, and I got in yesterday evening. So, from Houston. So I'm a little off right now.
Oh well, we didn't notice. Thank you so much for your.
No, I get it, Divi. Thank you for everything you did to bring this whole group together and to, you know, really just drive this. So I'm excited to be. Excited to be here and see so many friends.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, folks, thanks again. Really appreciate your contributions and for staying on and having more conversations. I think it was actually generative. I will be sending out an email about where we go here. If you feel inclined, please jump into the document and, you know, put any reflections, questions, thoughts in there as well. And for now, I wish everyone to have an amazing week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, y'all. Appreciate you.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Bye.